would. Why did he keep asking me about the stupid Hodag? Then the logging business died out, and the town shifted to Hodag tourism instead. 100 years later, they had a Hodag Country Festival, Hodag Park, Hodag BMX Club, Hodag Honda. The high school mascot was a Hodag. They even built a giant statue of the creature in front of City Hall. Tourists used to take pictures with it.
Let me guess. The shift hit and the creature came to life.
Something like that. Locals might not have believed in the Hodag, but the kids did, and some of the tourists, too. At some point, all that accumulated faith gained critical mass, and a pack of Hodags ran out of the woods and came after the crowd at the Hodag County Fair. Rhinelander is a walled town now. Bad news? Hodags lay 25 eggs at a time. Good news? Their leather and fur fetch a good price. So, the woods are back, but they're full of Hodags.
Someone sold the Honeycombers a Black Mark Hodag egg, he said.
Probably.
Why would the Honeycombers send a Hodag after you?
Because that's the third time I cut their phone line. I need to find out who hired Jasper. I stopped and pivoted to him. He smiled, showing me a forest of fangs that would give any sane person nightmares for life.
Nice, I told him. Who's Jasper?
Nobody. I pulled a rag from my pocket and wiped DeCon's blade. The stench made my eyes water.
Let's work together.
Let's not. He moved to stand in front of me again.
You and I carried on a civil adult conversation for the last 5 minutes.
I blinked at him. I failed to see your point.
You were distracted, and amazingly, you didn't demand that I leave, and you didn't try to run away from me. Clearly, you can control yourself in my presence.
Trust me, I'm doing a superb job controlling myself right now. When I lose control, you'll know about it.
Let's join forces. The faster we find Pastor Haywood's killer, the sooner I will leave this city. And your life again will be blissfully free of me, just as you like it.
He planned to leave again. Where will you go? Why did I ask that? The werewolf shrugged.
Home.
Where is home?
Not here.
It was like a stab to the heart. Atlanta used to be his home. Kate, Curran, and Conlin were still here. I was... Right. I wasn't. I recognized the look in his eyes. Derek had locked onto a target. It would be impossible to avoid him. I had exhausted all of my emotional reserves trying to shove him out of my orbit. He was powerful. He was an asset. We would help each other, and then he would leave. Jasper was the self-proclaimed king of the Honeycomb, I told him. A little girl, a street kid, witnessed Pastor Haywood getting into a car with a fatso who took him to identify the artifact. Someone hired Jasper to find her, so he got two of his flunkies and crawled out into the city. I got to the girl first. When Jasper couldn't find her, he caught one of the other street kids instead. The child wouldn't tell him anything about the girl or me, so Jasper and his two assholes beat him to within an inch of his life. Derek's hackles rose. Jasper had an iron hound and tracked me to St. Luke's Cathedral. When I came across the three of them, they were dragging the boy on a chain with him. He was black and blue. He couldn't stand. They broke his leg. They snapped his arm. They shattered his ribs. My voice was about to quiver. No, not happening. I scrambled to maintain some semblance of control. Derek took a step forward. A bullet dug into the concrete inches from my foot. I threw myself left and ducked behind a wall. Derek swore and jumped over the edge. I studied the two people Derek dropped on the concrete. He'd come up the stairs, carrying them by the back of their pants and dumped them in front of me. They seemed slightly rumpled, but their guts were still inside their bodies, which was a huge plus. The younger one had short chestnut hair and bronze skin and was probably a young girl in her mid-teens dressed in oversized men's clothes. The older one, about my age, had lighter skin, dark hair, and a dark beard, and the kind of look in his eyes that told me he expected to be beaten and had come to terms with it. "You sent a hodag after us." The man spread his arms.
"You cut the cable 3 times. Honestly, lady, what do you have against us? Do you cut other people's phone lines or is it just ours?"
"Just yours." He leaned back.
"What did we ever do to you? I don't know you." He turned to the girl. "Do you know her?"
The girl shook her head. He turned back to me.
"See? We don't know you. We need that line to survive. We need food. We need clothes. We need ammo, and backyard gardening only gets you so far."
"Gardening, huh?"
"Yes. We grow things. Tomatoes, cucumbers. We're peaceful folks. We mind our own business."
I pointed at the hodag's head. "To grow a hodag to that size, you have to feed it human meat." The girl looked freaked out. Surprise flashed in the man's eyes, but he recovered quickly.
"So he ate a few corpses. They would have rotted anyway. It's a circle of life thing, lady."
"Uh-huh. Circle of life.
What's your name?"
"Don't tell her, Cephas," the girl whispered and clamped her hand over her mouth. Cephas just looked at her for a second.
"I want to know about Jasper," I said. "We don't know Jasper," Cephas said.
Derek loomed above him.
"Answer her or I'll put your head in my mouth."
Cephas swallowed.
"Oh, Jasper? That Jasper. Yeah, okay. We do know Jasper. What about him?"
"Yesterday he took 2 of you and left to do a job. I need to know who hired him." Cephas spread his arms to the sky.
"Who knows? Jasper isn't the sharing type. He isn't exactly beloved. He had a hard childhood. The man has trouble processing his feelings, so when he has them, they make him angry. And when he gets angry, he lashes out."
"The last time I lashed out, Jasper lost his head. It's sitting on a metal tray in the order's morgue." The girl clutched on to Cephas. He put his arm around her and rearranged his expression, looking hurt.
"No need for threats. We're all friends here. The phone line is for everyone's use. You pay into the jar per phone call. Sometimes money goes to buy medicine. Sometimes Jasper takes it. He has poor leadership skills. I don't know who hired Jasper. I do know some people he worked with."
"Give me some names."
He looked at the sky. "Christy Costanza, Dallas Karen, Bambi No Last Name, Mark Rudolph, Felix Goswin."
"Okay," I told him. "You can go."
Cephas eyed me, glanced at Derek over his shoulder, looked at me again, grabbed the girl's hand, and took off. We heard them stomping down the stairs all the way to the bottom.
"They're really broken up about Jasper," Derek said. "I can feel their grief."
"You heard them. The man had trouble processing his feelings.
Probably kept most people at a distance. Never formed strong bonds with his peers. His inner core wasn't vibrating in tune to the celestial heartbeat."
A gust of wind tore at my hair. The world turned dark. The storm was almost on top of us.
"How is the boy?"
the massive werewolf next to me asked.
"I don't know. They told me he is hanging in there. I saw him this morning. He looked like he was dying."
I really had to shut up.
"The offer of a good med mage still stands."
"Thank you. If it's possible, the Methodists will heal him." "It bothers me. There are at least 30 minutes between White Street and St. Luke's. They dragged a boy on a chain and nobody fucking did anything about it. Why? Did the city go blind?"
"The city was always blind," he said, his voice hard. "People don't want to get involved. As long as it doesn't touch them, they can pretend it's not happening."
"People knew about his family and didn't help. People saw me in the streets every day and didn't help either." We stood next to each other. The wind pulled at his fur.
"What happens when we find Pastor Haywood's killer?" I asked.
"I'll rip his heart out."
It wasn't a turn of phrase. He meant it.
"It won't bring him back," Derek continued. "It probably won't make me feel better, but it must be done."
"This is nasty and complicated," I told him.
my favorite.
There is an avatar involved.
I've met a few gods.
Not like this one. If I tell you to sit a fight out, will you do it?
Sure.
Too easy. Sitting anything out wasn't in his nature. Promise me.
I promise.
I'll hold you to it. I held my hand out. Aurelia Ryder.
Clawed fingers swallowed my hand. Darren Argent.
It sounded familiar. Argent meant silver. Many shapeshifters took new names when joining a new pack, and I knew several who chose Argent as a last name. Silver killed like V, the virus responsible for their existence, and they considered the name ironic. Not a name I would expect him to pick for himself. Then again, Aurelia meant gold, and I chose it without considering its meaning. I wanted a name that reminded me of Julie, so one day I just looked at a list of Roman names and picked one that sounded pretty. Maybe I was reading too much into it. We shook and let go.
So, which of the four names Cephas mentioned rang a bell?
He asked. Mark Rudolph. He's on the list of relic hunters Bishop Chow gave me.
Then we should pay him a visit.
Yes, we should. I'll head down to the street, I told him.
Don't want to stay and watch me change?
There was a hint of humor in his inhuman voice. No.
What if something attacks me while I'm getting dressed?
I looked at the hodag head and then back at him. Throw the head at them and scream for help. I'll see you downstairs. I limped out of the building and whistled for Tulip. Someone had turned the muscles of my legs into wet cotton. I had expended way too much energy dodging the hodag, and now my freshly regenerated body was making me pay for it. My thigh hurt like hell. A wind gust hit me, tearing at my hair. Thunder rocked the world, the clouds broke open, and rain drenched me, warm and heavy. I raised my arms, closed my eyes, and let it wash over me, wishing all my troubles would drain away with the water. I could have stood under the rain forever. The sound of Tulip's hooves drew close and stopped. According to his address, Mark Rudolph had done quite well for himself. He lived all the way in Mount Paran Northside, an affluent neighborhood with 10,000 square foot mansions and home prices in the millions. If things had stayed the same since I left, that neighborhood was protected better than the White House. They hired off-duty PAD officers to patrol it and had their own private security force manning the perimeter wall and towers. Trying to get to the northern edge of Buckhead from here and then gain entry in this deluge was all but impossible. I had to go home and try tomorrow. At least I had a lead. My first real lead. I opened my eyes. A fully human Derek stood right in front of me. His eyes were aglow, and he looked at me as if I were the thing he wanted most in the entire world. I turned away from him and mounted. The rain is too heavy. I'm going home.
Tomorrow, then.
Tomorrow. I gave him my phone number. Call me if anything serious happens. As I rode away, he was still standing in the rain, watching me. Then I blinked, and he was gone. 13. Martin waved at me from my couch. I paused with my keys in my hand. I had put up Tulip, walked in, and there she was. If it weren't for her expression, I wouldn't have recognized her. The layer of grime covering her face and hair was gone, revealing a cute 7-year-old with big eyes and delicate features. Shoulder-length, copper-brown hair fell in soft ringlets around her adorable tan face. But her eyes were exactly the same, a light golden hazel, full of mischief. How did people keep finding me? I spent all this time and money making a secret hideout, and literally everyone I've met in the last 2 days now knew where it was. Martin grinned at me. I found you. I see that. Where is Sophia? Martin giggled. You didn't lead her into quicksand and leave her trapped somewhere, did you? She shook her head.
She had homework. I executed an evasive maneuver.
Right. How in the world had she snuck out past a shapeshifter? They could hear a fly buzz 200 yards away. How did you know where I live?
I'm smart. She was not going to answer. As soon as the magic came back, I'd scan her.
I shut the door. It was raining cats and dogs, and by now Sophia was probably going out of her mind. I pulled off my boots and took my dripping self to the kitchen. Here's hoping Barabbas still had the same number.
Sophia picked up on the first ring. Gilliam residence, how may I help you?
Have you misplaced a small child?
Ms. Ryder, I'm so, so sorry. I left her playing video games for 20 minutes and she was gone. I tried to track her, but the rain is too heavy.
So she bolted just before the rain started?
Yes.
It would take at least 30 minutes for a normal human child to get to my house from Kate and Curran's gated community. Martin's hair was dry.
I'll come and get her right away, Sophia promised.
Don't worry about it. It's flooding, so you can get her when the rain stops.
Thank you.
I gave her directions and hung up. Martin slunk into the kitchen and climbed onto a chair.
I saw a boy here.
Don't tell me. What did he look like?
He was pretty. He had dark hair and big gray eyes.
Conlon. Was he in the house or outside of it?
Outside.
Oh, good. The rain would have washed away his scent trail by now. Did you talk to the pretty boy? Martin nodded.
Yes.
What did he say?
He said to tell you that Grandma called the house.
What did that mean? Was there anything else?
That was it.
There had to be more to it. Eric called to talk to Kate as often as I did, usually through the fire because phones rarely worked for her. Conlon must have decided Martin wasn't completely trustworthy. I was somehow supposed to infer some deeper meaning from Grandma called. Martin pulled her knees up to her chest on the chair.
Can I stay with you until the rain stops?
Of course. Are you hungry? She nodded. My phone rang. Probably Barabbas or Christopher. Hold that thought. I picked it up.
You haven't spoken to your grandmother in 6 days, my uncle said.
How did Hugh get my number? He wasn't even in the same state. Does everybody know where I live?
Everybody who cares about your safety. Do you know how I know that it's been 6 days? Ask me.
Oi. How do you know?
I'm so glad you asked. Your grandmother mentioned it to me 5 times in the last 48 hours. She called me twice through the fire and 3 times on the phone. Hold on a second. Put down that cow!
I held the phone away from my ear.
Sorry about that.
How did she call you? Phones don't work for her.
Apparently, someone dials the number for her and she stands across the room and screams at it. Your grandmother has no trouble making herself heard. Boy, yes, I'm talking to you. What did I say?
I shook my head trying to get the ringing to stop. The two of them could roar loud enough to be heard all the way across a battlefield. I've heard them do it.
You seem pretty busy, Uncle.
Call your grandmother. She's worried about you. And she'll keep calling me until she hears from you. Otherwise, I'll be forced to come to Atlanta in person to verify that your arms and legs are still attached and you have not lost the ability to speak. And we both know how much I enjoy visiting Atlanta.
Oh, gods. That won't be necessary. I'll call her as soon as the magic is up.
Are you doing okay? Do you need anything?
I'm fine.
If you do need anything, you tell me. If you need backup, you tell me. I'll come down and smash some heads for you.
Aw, thank you.
Gotta go. Or what? I will show you what. You're about to find out, and you will tell your mother that you brought this on yourself.
I hung up.
Was that your daddy?
Martin asked. No, that was my uncle. My dad doesn't yell. He mostly roars.
My daddy is nice.
I thought she was an orphan. She smiled.
He brings me treats and presents, but he can't be with me right now.
What kind of father let his daughter live on the street? I got this really sick feeling. What does he do when he sees you?
He tells me stories, and he does magic tricks.
Does he ever touch you anywhere? Martin scrunched her face at me. He gives me hugs. He's not a creep.
Creep was street slang for child molester. For a 7-year-old, Martin was really sharp.
What happened to your mommy? I killed her, Martin said. When I was born.
Would you like a hug? I held out my arms. It's okay if you don't.
I want a hug.
She slid off the chair and hugged me. I patted her hair. You didn't kill her. Sometimes things like that just happen. She snuggled closer. Let me make another phone call and we'll cook dinner. Martin gave my kitchen a suspicious look.
I looked in your fridge and there was nothing there.
I have a secret fridge. Her eyes lit up. I picked up the phone. It was half an hour before 5. I bet that Stella was still in the office, and I was right. I thought you were coming by. What happened?
A hodag.
In Atlanta? Are you shitting me? Nope. Big one, too. Do you need me to bring you some lemons? Nope, I'm good. Could you check on a name for me? She sighed. What am I, your secretary? I'll owe you one. Fine, fine. What's the name? Darren Argent. Sounds odd enough. At least it's not John Smith. Who is he?
Someone I ran into.
Okay, I'll check it out. I said thank you and hung up. Martin jumped up and down.
Secret fridge?
Secret fridge. The rain stopped at about 9, and 15 minutes till 10, someone knocked on my door and then rang the bell. Martin looked up from her spot on the divan. She had eaten an entire steak by herself and 2 helpings of roasted potatoes. I still couldn't figure out where it all went. Afterward, she settled on the plush cushions. I gave her a book with illustrations of dinosaurs, which didn't seem to hold her interest. Next was a book about cats, then dogs, and finally we settled on the Encyclopedia of the Ancient World. It had tons of pictures, and she sank right into it.
I don't want to go. I want to stay in your secret garden house. It's not safe for you here.
Martin flopped on her back and put the book on her face.
I still see you, I told her. I like you better, she said. I like you too. When things calm down, you can come and stay with me.
She lifted the book and gave me a squinty stare.
You promise?
I promise. The doorbell rang again. Come on, I told her. She sighed and crawled off the couch, slow enough to make a sloth look like a sprinter. I followed. With great hesitation, Martin meandered down the path heading to the door. One of my ornate metal spheres waited on a narrow pedestal to the right of the path. She reached for it in passing. Don't, I warned her.
Why?
It's dangerous, she sighed. You know this is a secret place, I told her on the way to the front door. Don't tell anyone about it. She gave me the side eye.
I'm not a dummy.
I opened the door to Sophia dressed in pink bike shorts and a matching pink tank top. Her pale hair was damp, her glasses foggy. I didn't see a vehicle, so she probably ran here on foot. There were times when being a shapeshifter came in handy.
Once again, I'm dreadfully sorry.
Once again, don't worry about it. How are the two of you going to get back?
My other father is coming to pick us up. Can we wait here? He shouldn't be long.
Of course. Sophia came in, demurely sat down in a kitchen chair, and took in my kitchen. Clearly, certain calculations were taking place in her head. I had paid with gold, which didn't line up with my shabby house. I waited. She just sat there with a small smile on her face, offering no information and waiting for me to say something. Pure Barabbas. I set the tea to boil and set out 3 teacups. I'm curious about something. What do you have against Ascanio Ferrara? You had a strong reaction when I said his name. Sophia flushed. Embarrassment or crush?
I didn't realize. Thank you for making me aware of it. I'll make a better effort to hide my disgust in the future.
She was the most serious kid I'd ever met. But why the disgust?
Ascanio Ferrara is the devil, Sophia announced. One day he'll get what's coming to him, and I hope to be there.
A shadow swooped down on my lawn. I caught a glimpse of crazily large red wings just before they vanished, and a tall man strode to my front door. Martin sat up and smiled. A careful knock sounded. I opened the door. Christopher Steed stood outside. He wore a light gray suit that fit him like a glove. Tall, pale, with platinum blonde hair, he had one of those refined faces that looked elegant no matter his expression. His sharp eyes locked on me. "You don't know me. We've never met." He stared at me for 5 long seconds.
"We lost your child. My apologies."
Martin is resourceful. I suspect she's much more than that. That made 2 of us. "Please come in." I added another cup to the table. Christopher took the chair next to Martin. She gave him an angelic smile. "We were talking about Sophia's disdain for Mr. Ferrara."
"Ah." Christopher allowed himself a small smile. "By all means, continue."
"It's like this," Sophia said as I poured tea into the cups. "I have a group of friends." I put a jar of honey in front of Christopher and set a small bottle of cream next to it. "We are a very capable group." Christopher hid a smile and added honey to Martin's tea. She gazed at him like he was the most wonderful person in the world. "Most of my friends live in the same neighborhood, but one of them, B, lives with the pack. In a clan house."
Baby B. Raphael and Andrea's daughter.
"Her parents are what you might call overprotective."
"Andrea and Raphael? Overprotective?"
Raphael gave Baby B a dagger for her 2nd birthday and then laughed when she tried to stab him with it. "When B doesn't return to her clan house on time or when she forgets to tell them where she's going, they send Ascanio to fetch her. And since we're usually together, he takes it upon himself to fetch us as well."
"For which your parents are deeply grateful," Christopher said.
"That's beside the point, Father. The point is, he isn't my babysitter, or Conlin's, or Mann's and Ricardo's. He isn't in a position of authority over me. He simply decided to be insufferable."
"The tea is exquisite," Christopher said.
"I'm glad you like it," I told him. Sophia took a sip. Martin got a hold of the honey jar and was busily spooning honey into her cup. At this rate, she'd end up with honey tea syrup.
"You'll have to drink some of the tea to make space," I told her.
"For example," Sophia said, "one time we went to play in the sewers."
Martin stopped with her spoon in midair.
"The Impala worm is in the sewer." "We were being very quiet. It was perfectly safe until Ascanio found us and yelled at us, and of course the Impala worm showed up. He didn't have to fight it for 30 minutes, and he didn't have to almost drown. He created this situation and then chose to be dramatic about it."
I stared at her.
"How old were you?"
9.
Conlin would have been 6. Man and Ricardo would have been 5. Oh my gods.
"Then there was another time we wanted to go to Savannah for the pirate festival. We would have been back by morning, and all of us could swim. The boat was sinking very slowly, so there was no reason to panic."
"I feel like you skipped a part. How did you get on a boat?" I asked.
"We took a ley line to Savannah, but it doesn't go straight to the city."
Ley lines were persistent magic currents. They lasted even during tech, although they lost a lot of their speed. The ley line was like a train track with a continuous train running at high speed. To travel on a ley line, you had to have some kind of platform, a raft of metal, plastic, or wood. I'd ridden ley lines on old doors, and one time in a very large styrofoam cooler. Anything worked as long as it separated you from the current. The magic of ley lines sheared anything living, and walking into one would leave you without your legs. That's why the government put up billboards with graphic pictures of bodies cut into pieces by ley points. The points were another fun ley line feature. The current wasn't continuous. It had breaks called ley points, and when you reached one, the current ended abruptly and jettisoned you out. You had no choice about it.
"I know that ley point," I said. "It dumps you in a salt marsh."
which was why most people shipped goods from Atlanta to Savannah by cart or car. The ley line that led from Savannah to Atlanta was just fine, but that was the post-shift world for you.
We didn't know that bit, Sophia said.
So it dumped you in the middle of the marsh. Was it dark?
There was some light.
Was it moonlight?
Possibly.
Christopher smiled into his tea.
We were fine until the tide started coming in.
I stared at her. She shrugged.
There were no signs telling us where to go, and the scent trails were confusing. We found a boat. It was leaking only a little bit, so we were completely fine. It was fun. We were going to paddle to the coast. Except Ascanio showed up and made us go back.
Then there was the Minotaur, Christopher said quietly.
Sophia sighed.
I don't understand how the kids keep escaping, I said.
Was nobody watching them?
Shapeshifter children come with unique challenges, Christopher said. A certain degree of independence is highly encouraged.
It made sense to some degree. An average shapeshifter toddler was stronger and faster than most human adults, and their regeneration kept them relatively intact. But they were still kids.
Unfortunately, Christopher continued, when these six get together, they seem to develop an unshakable confidence in their own abilities to handle things, regardless of the reality of the situation.
Sophia glanced at him.
Five, Father. JJ is too young. We don't always invite him.
JJ?
Tell me about the Minotaur. It wasn't an actual Minotaur, which was a huge letdown, Sophia volunteered.
No, it was worse, her father said. Most Minotaurs are calm until they're provoked. This was a buffalo shapeshifter gone loop. He'd taken off into the North Forest after massacring his entire family. The pack's herd leader was away at the time, and the decision was made to wait until Eduardo returned to avoid unnecessary loss of life.
Dad would have gone in there by himself and killed it. I opened my mouth to ask why he didn't, and caught myself. Oops.
Why didn't the Beast Lord take care of it?
His predecessor would have. However, Shropshire is not that hands-on. The pack has developed procedures and protocols to handle a variety of situations, like this one, and he doesn't get involved until all other avenues have been exhausted.
Interesting. That was always the problem with the pack and Dad. He'd made the pack, or rather, it accreted around him, and he was the answer to all their problems. It wore him down. There were days when all he did was run around putting out pack fires. It looked like Jim had installed a structure that had been missing, and this type of incident could get ugly fast. If the wolves or the cats killed a bovine shapeshifter, even one gone loop, it could open a big can of worms.
One of my friends wanted to hunt the Minotaur, Sophia said.
I choked on my tea. I knew exactly which friend that was.
When was this?
A year ago.
Damn it, Conlon.
Sophia, how old were you? You should have known better. It was perfectly safe.
Clearly, that was her battle cry. Everything was on fire, and sharks and dragons were circling us, but it was perfectly safe.
How? We hid in the brambles, the black kind with red thorns. He was circling around the bramble bushes, but he couldn't get to us because he was too big. He would have gotten bored and gone away. But Ascanio showed up. Again.
I put my hands over my face.
As I have pointed out before, Christopher said, this was less about hunting a Minotaur and more about hiding from a Minotaur, trapped, with no escape route, while your parents frantically searched the entire city for you since the lot of you left a note that said, gone on a monster hunt.
Did he kill the loop? I asked.
Yes, Christopher said, eventually. Ascanio suffered a broken femur in his left leg, two broken ribs, and a collapsed lung, but he did kill the loop. My guess is he thought the children would die if he failed.
We helped! Toward the end. Well,
Conlon helped the most.
Sophia grit her teeth.
Do you know what he did after? He cursed at us, an adult man. And then, when I told him that we could run away from him because of his broken leg and he should be nicer, he put us in loop manacles. He what?
He's part of the PAC's loop rapid response unit. He always has loop manacles in his SUV, Christopher said. He manacled the children to one another and led them out of the woods like that.
Sophia flushed. Everybody saw. Everybody. I'll never forgive him. He'll get what's coming to him.
Oh my gods. He had to walk them out on a broken leg. And the ribs. Every breath would be fire. And now you know why my daughter isn't a fan of the man who constantly saves her and her friends from themselves.
Sophia opened her mouth. Christopher looked at her.
It's time for you to return home. Be careful. The roads are muddy.
Yes, Father. Sophia rose. Thank you for the tea. And for giving me another chance with Martin. I promise there won't be any more escapes.
You're welcome. She left. Ms. Ryder, if I could offer a word of advice.
Of course.
The situation in the pack is delicate. Jim Shropshire, the current Beast Lord, wants to retire. Leading the pack is an exhausting, high-pressure position, and he gets little thanks, but shoulders all the blame. He's missing the childhood of his children, and it's wearing on him. He will, however, continue until a worthy successor presents themselves. Such a successor must have support from the majority of the clans. Ascanio Ferrara is sizing up the Beast Lord's throne, and he thinks it will fit him. He may be right, but he has a long way to go. He has the brains, money, and the drive, but he lacks experience and the sheer physicality required for the role. He took on a loop buffalo. He's a superb fighter. The question is, can he inspire people to follow him? Can he walk onto a battlefield and lead the charge? That remains to be seen. Whatever you and he are involved in, and I'm not insinuating anything by that remark, keep in mind that if you put yourself in the path of his ambition, he will bulldoze over you.
Thank you.
He turned to Martin. Ready?
She gazed at him, her face serene.
Are we going to fly?
We are. The only question is, how high would you like to go?
Wait. I ran to the back of the house and came back with a thick sweatshirt and pulled it over Martin. It swallowed her. It will be cold up there.
Martin hugged me and held out her arms to Christopher. He picked her up and carried her out the front door. For a moment, they stood poised in the moonlight. Then two enormous blood-red wings burst from Christopher's back, beat once, and he streaked into the sky, taking Martin with him. The Theophage who had devoured Deimos, the Greek god of terror, was flying away with the little girl I cared about, and I was totally okay with that. A pair of ruby eyes caught the light in the shadows across the street. A Buddha. Ascanio must have left someone to watch my house, and they had just given themselves away. Sloppy. Or they wanted me to know I was being watched. My phone rang. Looked like my night wasn't over yet. I went inside and picked it up. I found Darren Argent. All humor was gone from Stella's voice. I have a feeling I'm not going to like this. Do you know what Ice Fury is? The largest shapeshifter pack in the United States. They're based in Alaska. Half of them have gone wild, and they don't like outsiders. Darren Argent is the beta of Ice Fury.
Cold washed over me. I remembered where I had heard the name. There was no way. It couldn't be Derek.
There are more warnings on his file than I have ever seen. This guy is death on legs.
Is there a description? Maybe he just used the name.
Male, white, early 30s, dark hair. He's kind of hard to misidentify. He's got scars all over his face.
The world stood on its hands and kicked me in the face.
You said you ran into him.
Urgency vibrated in Stella's voice. Tell me he isn't in Atlanta right now. Because if he is, the Night Protector has to know. I can't know this and not tell him. Of course, a prominent member of the largest shapeshifter pack entered Atlanta's pack territory and didn't denounce himself. Nick would expect a shapeshifter war. Go ahead and tell him. I already did. Then why the hell did you ask me? I wanted to know what you would say. Stella! Feldman wasn't happy. He wants you to come in. Let him know I'll be there first thing in the morning. No, he wants you to come in right now. Right now wouldn't be happening. I had to figure out how to handle this situation, and I was so exhausted I could barely stand. I'll be there in the morning. Tell him that it's not a shapeshifter war. Stella exhaled into the phone. Aurelia, in the morning. I have to go. I hung up. A few years ago, a family of were-rats joined the new Shinar, husband, wife, and their two children. They were originally from California, but had had a falling out with the rest of their extended family and had gone up to Alaska to join Ice Fury. Things didn't work out, and once the husband's father died, they packed up and moved back south to take care of the husband's mother. At the time, Era had wanted as much information about Ice Fury as she could get, and the family spent several days telling us about their former pack. Some of it we already knew. A lot of it we didn't. Ice Fury consisted mostly of wolves and bears. At least one third of the pack had gone wild, meaning they spent more time in fur than in human skin. Atlanta's pack was forced to interact with human society. Ice Fury made sure they didn't have to. About 10 years ago, Mihail Kamenov, an enormous Kodiak from Siberia, took over as Ice Fury Alpha. He favored a hands-off style of leadership. From what the rats had said, he spent most of his time in the woods, coming out only when there was a problem that needed to be crushed with his giant paw. Ice Fury was run by a series of betas. The latest beta, and the one who'd lasted the longest, was Darren Argent. The were-rats couldn't really tell us what was so special about Darren, but when they described him, their eyes glazed over. He had some sort of pull, some kind of magnetic thing about him that other shapeshifters, wolves especially, instantly recognized. Shapeshifters flocked to him. According to the father of the family, Darren could have taken the pack away from Mihail whenever he felt like it, and Ice Fury would back him up. At the time, I'd guessed that Darren was a first. The legend said that during prehistoric times, some humans made bargains with animal deities, and that's how the first shapeshifters came about. Descendants of those bloodlines were very rare, even during the time of the old Shinar. I only knew of one, Curran. The firsts were capable of remarkable things. Other shapeshifters sensed them somehow and would follow them through fire. Derek wasn't a first. Someone would have recognized it by now. It wasn't a thing one could hide. His dad had gone loop, and the firsts had the highest loop resistance. According to Era, they were practically loop-proof. And if his mother had been a first, she would have squashed his dad like a bug the first time he raised his hand to her. Whatever that magnetic thing was, the old Derek didn't have it. Becoming a beta of anything was a 180-degree turn for him. Derek hadn't just shown zero interest in climbing the shapeshifter leadership ladder, he actively avoided it. Dessandra had offered him the beta position repeatedly, and he'd declined every time. So he left Atlanta for no apparent reason, went up to Alaska, and became the de facto ruler of Ice Fury. Why? I could just imagine Curran's reaction to it. Why did you have to go across the country to be a beta there? What's wrong with the pack I built? Is it not to your liking? What was so bad about it that you had to move to a frozen hellhole and run around the woods with a bunch of crazy people who don't want to be people anymore? I dragged my hand across my face. I would not want to be there for that conversation. When Curran retired from being Beast Lord, a group of people from his immediate circle separated with him. Like Curran, they enjoyed immunity. They had a right to be in the pack's territory without being subject to Jim's authority. Derek was one of those people.
but now he was also the Beta of a rival pack. If he truly was the Beta of Ice Fury, his presence in Atlanta was a catastrophe. Shapeshifters, especially high-ranking shapeshifters, didn't just enter other packs' territory. There were protocols in place, and Derek hadn't followed any of them, or Ascanio wouldn't be chasing him all around the city. It looked bad. It looked like Derek had snuck into the city to assess the Atlanta pack for a possible attack. Although Ice Fury was far away, rival shapeshifter packs were known to stage raids. On the surface, the idea was absurd because of the distances involved, but shapeshifters were a paranoid lot. The very act of him entering Atlanta could be taken as a declaration of war, and yet the pack probably couldn't do much to him personally because of his immunity. This was a diplomatic nightmare. I stared at the wall, trying to sort through this tangled mess in my head. Now would be the perfect moment for some wise wizard or a messenger of some god to pop in and explain it all to me. Derek was in Atlanta illegally, and Ascanio was chasing him all around the city. Most likely, Ascanio hadn't reported it to anyone because, according to Derek, he had a mysterious score to settle. Ascanio always had an angle, and for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what it was. How did this benefit him? Was he planning to subdue Derek and bring him in, pulling him out like a rabbit from a hat? Look at who I found. He probably had no idea Derek was Darren Argent. It would backfire. Oh, dear gods, it would so backfire. If Ascanio somehow succeeded, he would assault and drag a foreign beta before the Beast Lord. If he failed and got hurt, a foreign beta would have injured the beta of Clan Buddha. The two of them were idiots. What were they even doing? They hadn't seen each other in years. They were two grown men. There had to be more to this than some teenage feud. I felt like I was looking at a heap of puzzle pieces with all of the corners missing. And now Nick knew. Nick, who was in love with Dessandra and who was the stepfather to her two boys. In a shapeshifter war, Dessandra would be on the front lines, and unless the Order gave him their blessing, Nick wouldn't be able to fight beside her. He would react. I had no idea how, but it would be bad. Really, really bad. I had to contain Nick. I'd bought myself a little bit of time, but I couldn't dodge him forever. If Curran were still the Beast Lord, Derek would have been given about 6 hours of freedom, and then he would get a formal invitation. Something along the lines of, "We are delighted that the Beta of Ice Fury has graced us with his presence and anxiously await his arrival at the Keep. We're dying to meet him face to face." It would have been delivered by Clan Rat, and knowing them, it would just magically appear on Derek's pillow while he took a shower. Where were the rats? Clan Rat handled the pack's security. I hadn't seen a single rat operative in the city. They were very good, so I might not have noticed them, but still, they would keep an eye on Ascanio. What in the bloody hell was going on with Atlanta's pack? Ah, I didn't have time for any of this. I needed to get to Mark Rudolph and squeeze the information out of him before any more people got murdered or the Maverim made their next move. My head was killing me. I desperately needed rest. Either I went to bed now, or my body would shut me down and I'd fall asleep right here on the floor. Maybe I would get a flash of brilliance in the morning. I locked my doors, both of them, and dragged myself to bed. 14. The morning brought a fresh magic wave, and a strong one, too. The lotuses in the basin bloomed in seconds, and now their petals glowed gently above the water. I brewed a fresh pot of tea and built a fire in the cauldron. The flames licked the dry wood, it caught, and I tossed a handful of herbs into the fire. They ignited in a flash, turning the flames blood red. Magic splayed from the cauldron. I grasped it and reached through it to my grandmother. Her voice came through first. 7 days! How very modern of you! The flame snapped into the image of my grandmother. Tall and broad-shouldered, in real life she towered over me. Like Kate, she was stunning.
powerful face, beautiful features, bronze skin, and a wealth of black hair streaming down over her shoulders. I'd seen her in armor and in formal gowns, with gold jewelry tracing her brow and neck. Seeing her in a tank top and sweatpants never failed to crack me up.
"Ungrateful child. I see you smirking. Was my worrying funny to you?"
"No, ma'am."
"Ugh." Era shook her head. "Tell me everything that's happened."
By the time I brought her up to speed, I was on my second cup of tea.
What a damn mess.
Don't I know it?
"What are you going to do about Feldman?"
"Depends on where his mind is when I meet him this morning. I must contain him at all costs, or he might mobilize the chapter and start a manhunt to find Derek. Or worse, he might rope the pack into it."
"That man is good at keeping secrets. Use it."
"I'll do my best." Era frowned.
"Tell me about this divine beast."
"I have no idea what it is. I have never seen that magic signature before. I've never heard of anyone eating some creature's heart to see the future. There are legends of people eating mystical birds' hearts and gaining magic powers, but nothing that fits."
My grandmother tapped her fingernails on something, thinking.
"You said the historian had a chance to flee, but she didn't take it."
"Yes, it looked like she started to, but stopped."
"It must have spoken to her."
"Why?"
Era drained her cup.
"An academic like her would be trained to keep an open mind. Something made her more curious than frightened, and as a teacher, she would place great value on communication. If the beast spoke, she would stop and listen to it. She would reason and ask questions."
"How did I not see it before?" "That makes perfect sense." The list of creatures that could speak was short. The general rule was if the creature was depicted with a human head, it had the power of speech, provided it reached a high level of magic or the right age. Lamassu was one. The manticore was one too, although the manticores I'd run across were beast-like and never spoke. Sphinxes, nagas, harpies.
"An idiot would have run away and kept running. Sometimes our intelligence is to our detriment."
Era sighed.
"There has been a development. If you hear about any incidents related to the casino and necromancers, try to avoid that area."
"Why?"
Era hesitated.
"Grandmother?"
"Namtur is in Atlanta."
I choked on my tea. "What is the High Sakan doing here?"
"Damned if I know. He said he wanted a respite. I gave him a month, and what does that ingrate do with his vacation? He goes to Atlanta and gets himself captured by the necromancers."
Now her frantic attempts to reach me made sense. Namtur was a ticking time bomb. She didn't even trust Hugh enough to tell him about it. Probably because he would have dropped everything and come to drag Namtur out of Atlanta before he caused a massive incident.
He let the people capture him? How are they still alive?
"They're alive because he has some kind of scheme. That's what I'm afraid of."
When Namtur schemed, streets ran red with blood. Literally.
"I thought we agreed that I would handle Atlanta on my own."
Era raised her hands.
"I didn't send him there. I didn't even know where he was until Gostek called us 2 days ago."
Gostek, the head of the people, now EIN, in Atlanta, was trouble. He was calculating and ruthless. A navigator armed with a single vampire could wipe out a SWAT team in seconds. Gostek could easily pilot two at a time, and had enough navigators under his command to massacre everyone in the city in 24 hours. I couldn't afford him as an enemy. Not right now.
What did Gostek want?
"He wanted me to send someone to escort Namtur back. He's worried about Namtur's safety because he is elderly."
I opened my mouth. Nothing came out.
That was my reaction, too.
"Could he know who Namtur is?"
Era grimaced.
"I doubt it. That old fox can look so decrepit you'd think he couldn't make it up a flight of stairs."
"Gostek is a lot of things, but he isn't an idiot. If he has even an inkling of what Namtur is, he wouldn't have detained him."
I honestly don't think he knows. Eris shook her head. None of this is your problem. I just wanted to warn you, so if something happens, you don't run headfirst into the casino and get exposed.
If Namtor started killing the EIN personnel, Kate would get involved.
Kate and Gostek had a complicated relationship. When Grandfather attacked the city to subdue Kate, Gostek had thrown his lot in with Kate. For a short time, he became her legatus, the head of the navigators under her banner. When Kate gave up her claim to the city, he had argued against it. I remembered hearing that conversation. He'd actually raised his voice. For some reason, he desperately needed her to remain in power, but she had no interest in ruling anyone or anything. They had had a falling out over it, but Kate considered him a friend. If Namtor caused trouble, she would come to Gostek's defense. That was the last thing I needed. I'll go and get him. He can handle himself. He made that mess. He can get himself out of it. Grandmother, he is your blood brother. He can't be allowed to run around unsupervised in the city with the Mavarim sniffing all over the place, Gostek plotting God's knows what, and me trying to hide. I'll go and get him right now. He likes me. He will come with me. If you pick him up, you won't be able to get rid of him. I'll find him something to do. I love you. I have to go now. I love you too. Be careful. Always. Of all the places in Atlanta, the EIN casino was my least favorite. Cavernous and devoid of windows, the main floor resembled a luxurious cave decorated in rich purple and gold hues and filled with rows and rows of slot machines. Entering through the main gate put you straight in the middle of it. The slot machines, rigged to work during magic or tech, flashed with bright lights and played jarring music, keeping the patrons awake. The people in front of them stared at the screens with vacant eyes, while waiters glided between them, offering alcohol and caffeinated drinks. There was something infantile about the bright lights, oversaturated colors, and treats delivered on demand, and the chaos of it unraveled you until you lost yourself to ringing tunes and spinning screens and became one of the anonymous gamblers. I turned left, where two journeywomen in identical purple blouses and black pencil skirts waited behind a marble counter. The path from sensing an undead to becoming a full-fledged navigator and earning the coveted Master of the Dead title was long and took years. Those who embarked on it became journeymen. Most of them never made it. I flashed my order ID. Please let Mr. Stefanov know that I'm here to pick up Mr. Sakan. When talking to non-Shinar people, Namtor used his title as his last name. Please wait, the shorter journeywoman told me. I parked myself in the lounge area, a soft, shadowy spot, tucked away into an alcove and furnished with overstuffed purple couches. Below the floor, underneath the slot machines, the gamblers, and the gaudy carpet, vampire minds glowed like angry smears of foul magic. Ugh. They glowed in my mind, evenly spaced, each undead confined to its own stall in the stables under the building, 20 per column. 1, 2, 3, 10, at least 600. Probably more. The dots were beginning to blend in the distance. Kate would have known precisely how many. She could also pilot them all at once. I used vampire blood, molded it, and worked with it, but piloting was forever beyond me, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I would not share my mind with one of those things. A male journeyman in his late teens stopped by me. The director will see you now. I followed him deeper into the bowels of the casino. Director? That was something new. I supposed it went well with their new name, the Eastern Institute of Necromancy. Why Eastern? Was there a Western Institute? In the next few hours, I needed to get Namtor, somehow convince Nick to stand down, do something with Namtor to keep him occupied and out of trouble, and then go see Mark Rudolph. There were too many fires to put out, and if I didn't do it fast enough, Moloch's priests would set the kind of fire I couldn't deal with.
We reached the back wall and walked through a hallway past a velvet rope, into a wide room ending in a spectacular staircase. Gostek came down the steps, a tall, gaunt figure in a black suit and charcoal dress shirt. He'd been balding as long as I could remember, but the receding hairline only accentuated his high forehead. His features were narrow, and he looked at the world with piercing, dark eyes. Usually, Gostek wore a turtleneck or a henley, sometimes a sweater. His clothes were simple, but expensive. He dressed like a busy CEO who had too much on his plate to worry about dressing up. Why the suit? It couldn't be for me. I was an anonymous order knight. His gaze fastened on me.
Ms. Ryder, I presume.
Knight Ryder, he smiled. Did I say something funny?
Not at all. You're too young to get the reference, and it would take too long to explain. What's your relationship to Namtor?
Direct and to the point. No pleasantries. My disguise was holding. I don't have one. I was told to escort him to the chapter. Gostek studied me. I had made a reasonable effort to look as normal as possible and hid most of myself with my ragged cloak. People in cloaks were a common sight in the city, and he could see my face well enough.
You're not one of Feldman's regulars.
I've been recently assigned to the chapter. If you contact the Order, they will confirm my credentials. Gostek looked at me for another long moment and said under his breath,
Bring him.
Somewhere in the depths of the casino, a vampire had just spoken in Gostek's voice. We waited. Gostek stared at me. Most people would at least try to pretend to look elsewhere out of politeness. Gostek openly scrutinized me. Two journeymen appeared at the top of the stairs. A short, elderly man walked between them. He wore a dark brown tunic that was two sizes too big and hung around him like a sheet on a clothesline. Age had stolen his hair and cut wrinkles into his walnut brown skin, but his eyes, the color of clover honey, were alert and bright. He saw me. His eyes sparkled, and he straightened up and picked up speed, sandals flashing under the hem of the tunic. The journeymen struggled to keep up. Gostek turned to look at him, taking his eyes off me for a second, and I put two fingers on my lips and touched the outer corner of my right eye in a single, quick motion. You do not know me. A small smile flickered on Namtur's lips and vanished. He was the one who'd taught me the language of thieves. Gostek turned back to me. I presented him with a blank, almost bored expression. Just a knight preparing to escort a senior citizen. Nothing to see here. Namtor stopped about 2 feet away and gave Gostek a withering look.
What is it now? Are you offering me this pretty child? What is an old man like me supposed to do with her?
Gostek looked offended.
A knight has come to escort you to the Order. I didn't realize Aratim and the Order had such close ties.
Using my grandmother's full name wouldn't score him any brownie points. Namtur stuck his chin in the air.
The things you don't know or realize are an ocean, and your mind is a tiny boat upon its waves.
Ancient disses were the best.
Delightful,
Gostek said dryly. I needed to move this along. Do I need to sign anything? A group of people came around the corner from my left, led by a woman in a light green dress that did wonders for her already spectacular figure. Her long red hair dripped on her shoulders. Rowena, one of the Masters of the Dead, the second most powerful necromancer in Atlanta. She had to be in her 50s, and she was still gorgeous. I always suspected that she and Gostek were an item, but nobody could ever prove it. The three men behind her wore identical outfits, dark pants, dark tunics, and heavy ceremonial cloaks, artfully draped over their shoulders. The leading man, older, with white hair and bronze skin, wore a cloak the color of jade, and the two younger men trailing him had cloaks the color of turquoise. People of the Sun. There goes the neighborhood. Among the Aztec cults, the People of the Sun were the strongest. Even before the shift, 12 million Mexicans spoke the Aztec language. After magic had flooded the world, the Aztec mythology and religion came back full force. Some of it was good, and some of it was horrifying. The people of the sun worshipped Huitzilopochtli, the god of war, sun, and sacrifice, and they controlled random spots all over the Southwest. Anyone could join. They didn't discriminate by national origin, gender, sexual orientation, or magical abilities, as long as you prayed to their god and no other. So far, the people of the sun stayed away from mass human sacrifice, probably because they were powerful enough without it. We had run up against them during our time in L.A., and they had been one of the factors that prompted our move to San Diego. Rowena's group headed straight for us. This was planned. Gostek meant for us to see each other. It couldn't be for me, so it had to be for Numtur. Rowena moved slightly to the side, and I saw the older man's face. Tizoc, one of the Tecutli, the lords, old, powerful, dangerous as hell. His real name was Luke O'Sullivan. Most of his family still lived in Boston, and he occasionally made trips up there for Thanksgiving. The two guys behind him were likely Jaguar warriors, elite fighters who served as Tecutli personal bodyguards. I turned away, so my hood blocked my face. Tizoc and Numtur had tried to negotiate before, and it was hate at first sight. Could this get any worse? The two old men saw each other. For an instant, nobody moved. Tizoc recovered first.
Numtur, you geriatric desert snake. I thought I smelled something foul, and there you are.
Numtur ignored him. We shall leave now. All around us, the smears of undead magic moved closer. There were six vampires right above, ready to fall through the ceiling, and more were coming. Gostek expected a confrontation. He'd arranged it, and now he was preparing to contain it.
Running,
Tizoc mocked. Numtur made no indication that he'd heard him. The ultimate insult. He'd decided that Tizoc was so insignificant, he was beneath notice.
Night, woman, I do not have time to stand around.
Looks like we'll be going now, I said to Gostek. Tizoc flicked his fingers and the two guards moved to block the exit.
Who is the errand girl? The best your bitch queen could send for you? A child in rags?
Tizoc reached for me. Numtur moved so fast he blurred. His hand knocked Tizoc's fingers away.
You dare?
Turquoise mist boiled out of Tizoc like two glowing wings. His eyes shone with green. I had to stop this, or people would die. I put my hand on Namtur's shoulder and moved so Tizoc could see my face. He jerked as if shot.